Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 50 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, obviously, it's congratulations to us on making it to our half century. However, personally, I think that the real party should happen at episode number 52, which will, of course, mark the 1 year anniversary of this podcast. Really, it's quite astonishing to think that we've been going for almost a year. I've learnt an incredible amount since speaking to Peter Young, our CEO, for the first time all those weeks ago in El Salvador in episode one. I've also seen this movement grow quite steadily in lockstep with our listener numbers. The Free Cities movement is most certainly a long game that we're all playing, and I can see that very clearly now. But after speaking about it for nearly 100 hours already on this pod, which is quite hard to believe, my opinion is that the question is now not if, but when. And it may be sooner than you think. Anyway, back to today. And we have Titus Gabel back on the show. Well, I had to have someone special for our 50th. This time, we're talking about the update to his classic book, Free Private Cities. What's new, what's gone, and what lessons have we learnt since the last edition was published just over 5 years ago? Of particular interest to me were questions that I had about subjects such as preferred architecture and design of free cities, along with Free Cities culture, ethics, and we get a rundown of the main innovations that have emerged since the last book. We end by discussing the COVID pandemic and how Titus predicts that a free private city operator would respond to something similar were it to happen in the future. Well, if you're interested in the other two podcasts I've done with Titus, look up episode number 36 for a deep dive into medieval city-states, and episode 34 for a broader discussion on the Free Cities movement in general. Don't forget that you can get Titus's new book along with Alex Voss's Strategies for Liberty, Free Cities and Bitcoin, and Calvin Dukes's Entrepreneurial Communities, an Alternative to the State, on the Free Cities website, which is free-cities.org/books. Before you do that, though, I would highly advise you to sit back, relax, and, as always, enjoy my conversation with Titus Gabel. It's fascinating. And actually, you know, there's a couple of things that I've noticed that I'm really interested to hear your opinions on. Architecture, culture, and also, am I right in thinking there's a chapter on how free private cities would have dealt with the COVID situation?
Yes.
That's fascinating. Yeah. What about starting with the first major difference between the original book and the new edition? It's an updated version. So maybe, are we talking whole new chapters? I haven't actually seen it, unfortunately. It's down at the conference, but I haven't got a copy. Are we talking whole new chapters or just abridged chapters?
No, we have six completely new chapters and one chapter went out. And so it's really partly a new book. And this is so because over the last 5 years, I discovered, okay, some items, some issues are important and I should discuss them in regard to free private cities. And that is also a learning process, right? I have discussed with so many people and I didn't, for example, take much notice of architecture, but I'm not an architect, right? So I said, okay, well, somehow it's done, right? But over the time when I was talking to our supporters, to our shareholders, to our chief architect. Now we have a great guy, Martinus Grobler from Cape Town. I discovered this is a very, very important topic and we should cover it. And so this happened. And then things like COVID happened, right? We say a lot of people ask me, how would you have dealt with that, right? And so far it is very, I think it was just time after 5 years to come up with something which is filling the gaps. So I have not only overworked the book and here and there's an additional interesting idea or some things that were redundant have been cut out. But again, there are 6 completely new chapters because the world has developed. So, for example, we have first experience in Honduras with other special zone projects, with even NEOM, Liberland, seasteading. This has all only happened really in the last years. So I thought that is something that should go into the book, and especially since I was involved in Honduras, and so much shit has been told about that project. I said, okay, let's put some things right. And then we have a development in the special economic zone industry towards what I call special administrative regions. And that also is basically getting momentum only after I wrote my first edition of the book. So this is something also we have to cover. And then I found out, okay, ethics is an issue that is probably not adequately addressed with all my ideas so far, and we can talk about that later. And then culture was also something important. So these are things that I said, okay, that's true, right? I haven't said much about that. I should, and that's what I did now.
Do you know what I want to know though? What chapter did you lose? Like what? That's interesting.
Yeah,
something obviously isn't as important as you thought.
Yeah, I left the chapter with the 3 different how could the world look like in the future, because it was partly redundant. So because I had already said how would a free private city look in the future, and that was cut out, and some other points were cut out which were not directly linked with the topic. Why? Because otherwise the book would have too voluminous. But I think as it is now, right, it's really, if you want to get involved in that sector and want to know about the ideas behind it or want to start your own project, I think now you have it all. And you can say, hey, okay, let's get some ideas from Tito's book, right? And we don't have to take over all of the ideas, but I think it's now relatively complete if you can say that we are talking about forming new societies, right? I mean, this is a big topic. But I think the main things have been covered now, and I think I can say that because it took me 30 years to get the knowledge to write the book, and now I have intensely discussed this with all kinds of people all over the world, and I can say now, probably now we got covered everything. Certainly there are things in future artificial intelligence that will play a role that we don't know yet, but I think if you want to start now, you are as complete as somebody can be.
And is it just the free private city model, or are you incorporating now more of the community aspects that we now acknowledge on the spectrum of new communities that aren't necessarily the free private city model and the contract? And are you including that in the book?
Yeah, I would say if you have a free city model which is different from the free private city model, you can use many of my ideas and chapters for your model. But I still think that the free private city model is the best for the reasons I outlined before, right? That because you have a contract and the incentive structure is just better. But again, within, for example, taking culture or architecture, that is not unique to free private cities. So everybody can take that ideas and say, hey, we are going to use from the 32 chapters, 16 is implementation, and we are using 8 of Tito's chapter ideas. That is definitely possible.
Okay, then. Well, speaking of architecture, because this is, for me, the architecture side of it is hugely important. I'm a pretty visual person, but I also seek out nice architecture in my life. The house I live in is 400 years old. We're about to buy a 500-year-old house, you know, and I'm specifically enjoy the notion of the architecture. And I'm absolutely turned off, for example, by postmodernism, yeah. You know, like what's his name, Le Corbusier, you know, this kind of anti-beauty stuff. It really does turn me off, and I know that there's almost a bit of an association between, oh, if it's new, it's a new thing, it's this new way of living, this new models, and people almost expect there to be crazy square buildings in the modernist style, and I think they're very antisocial, really anti, almost that they are anti-human sort of designs. I don't know, what was your conclusion?
Basically the same, right? I had a vague feeling, as I told you before, I wasn't really into architecture at all. That was just not my topic. But then I had already a vague feeling that this is ugly, right? What they're producing now with the steel and concrete and glass. And that's why people are all, one out of seven people is a tourist every year, right? Of the whole world. So it's more than a billion people who are tourists every year. And they are all gathering in the old places, right? They're going to Rome, Venice, Paris, the old towns, Vienna, and not the new stuff, or only to a very limited. Nobody is going as a tourist to Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, because it's ugly. It's modernistic piece of shit. And then I thought, why is this, right? And then some of our people recommended me some books, and I was especially intrigued by Leon Krier, architect from Luxembourg, who said, look, we have built houses for many, many hundreds of years in a certain type and for a reason. It was not only function, it was also beauty, because people need beauty. And then suddenly some people come up in the 1920s and say, it's only function, and then they were even getting, I think that relates with the art, development in art, and then drawing pictures, that it's boring to draw nice pictures, so let's make ugly ones, and then that has now developed into something where I tell all my friends, if you think this is art, then consider, my view is, if a 12-year-old can reproduce it, it's not art, it's just a piece of shit. And this is still my view, and the same is true with architecture. If you really want to create something that people like living in, people like looking at, and that is probably still there in 200 or 300 years, it will probably rather look like the people have built around 1900s. Look here in Prague, we are currently in Prague, the old town, right? This is, everybody likes that. And that is 1800, 1900, around that era. So, and compared it what is built after the war today, but people don't like it, right? And it's just true. And so I said, hey, we have to take this into consideration for our free private city models.
The modernist movement is the kind of culprit here. And in architecture, I think it was a response to the end of the war and people thinking, you know, something's wrong, you know, these things aren't working because we're having world wars. What are we going to do? And the modernists kind of jumped on that little bandwagon and said, you know, architecture's wrong as well, you know, and if your form follows function and all that kind of stuff, rather than what we all know, that I think anyway, that beauty and buildings have a part of them, of their kind of construction, which is about beauty. Part of their function is beauty. Mm-hmm. And I just think that whole movement has a lot to answer for. It's destroyed so many things. It's the movement that told us that, you know, and I understand being a contrarian or saying that everything that went before us is wrong, we need to try something new. But in the case of modernism, it was like they went against, I think, human nature.
Yes.
And it's not relevant to do that. That's just being a contrarian. You know?
And And I found out when studying this and discussing that, that this is related to our other topics. And one of the topics that we, that I make is that we should really not master plan the whole city. This is against our ideas that people should be free to choose what they prefer. And of course, the concept so far was, okay, we have an inner core of the city where there's more planning because we want to keep it attractive, and we will probably remain owners of that part. But the more you go to the outside, the more people can do what they want. So, and I found out now that in architecture, and especially with modernism, it was more a fancy idea of the elites, right? People never liked that. It's only elite idea. And if you only have a small group of architects and writers and journalists and some donors, rich ladies, to say, that's so great, right? You would say today the emperor is naked, but they said it's so great. And then the mayors and local politicians, totally clueless, then they talked after that, say, yeah, it's great, because everybody wants it. It's in all magazines. But the people on the street, they probably ever disliked that modernistic building from the beginning, from day one, with or without war, right? And so this is a problem. The problem is that there's a small group of people who is shaping the cities of today, and that's not right. A city is only a city for all if everybody has contributed. And interestingly, now that I'm taking care of those issues, wherever I travel, I have open eyes for architecture. And for example, if you go to Brazil, and I've been to Rio de Janeiro recently, and I've looked at the favelas, I must say, this is not unplanned development. And okay, they are poor, but you see the density is much higher, and the buildings are built together. And actually, if they would use better materials, that would be quite beautiful, right? A little bit like in Greece, right? They're also very dense and small houses. But it's a natural development. A natural development does not mean squares and skyscraper one beneath skyscraper two, because people don't have the funds to do that. They would just buy a small piece of land and build their house, and the neighbor would stick their house against it. And that's how our medieval cities look like in Europe, right? And so we at Tipolis, you know, I'm not only a writer, I also have a company called Tipolis who wants to make free private cities and related model a reality. And we have developed a model with our architect that says, okay, if there was a free market development possible over several hundred years, how could this have looked like? And then you get some, of course, this is just an attempt, right? You will never get it completely right because it's more speculation. But you say, okay, you have certain developments over time, over hundreds of years, that are always the same. So let's assume we have this starting from now. How would it develop? And interestingly, of course, it depends a lot on topography and that, but these type of cities that are coming out of this model, they look rather like Renaissance or antique cities than the cities of today, the modern cities of today. And so that is something which makes perfect sense to me, because the moment you leave people decide their own city, they will not come up with big quarters, right? We will still have that is a real estate developer saying, this is my idea, how it should look like. And if he make his modernistic quarter and people want to live there, I have no problem with that. But I think that is not going to happen. That is only going to happen in some areas, but the majority of people, they prefer beautiful buildings.
What about the actual layout of the city then? What conclusions did you come to with an architect? Are we talking squares? Are we talking long boulevards?
Okay, not totally straight roads all the time, because this is boring and you feel better if it's a bit windy, right? But there is, we have a model. This is, look, if we create free private cities, we're starting from scratch. Why? Because you want 100% voluntary consent. That's why we have to start from scratch, because you never get this in an existing city. And one of the ideas, there's a marina or even a port, and from this port there's an access toward the main plaza, or piazza, as the Italians say. That is the only really straight road. This is our main angle, main axis of the city, and more or less the idea that cities look like that, and you can recognize them. But from there, it's more or less using existing paths. That is also what happened in history, and making some planning. Okay, the main roads are here, and then within those, some roads, and here could be an airport, and there could be a port, and you keep the access free, and maybe here's the industrial zone. But other than that, we would not micromanage master plan into the details, other than maybe saying maximum 5 stories or something.
What about zoning? It's a bit of a bugbear. A lot of people hate the idea.
I think there is some zoning necessary because of conflicts of interest between heavy industries, heavy noise and emissions, and living quarters. But otherwise, it's absolutely, I think, not a problem to mix commercial and living. So we would really do a very limited zoning, just separating the heavy industries with noise and other emissions from the rest of the town. But this is more or less all.
With regards to style of building, I don't know how deeply you studied this, but how much does it work out cheaper or more expensive than knocking up a box with windows on it? I would imagine that that's quite an important factor, and I would say it's a lot more expensive to build a beautiful looking building, but correct me if I'm wrong. Is it
not necessarily? It's certainly more expensive than just living in a container, right? I concede that, but skyscrapers are mostly not really cheaper, because the higher you build, the more expensive it is for all the static and all the stability and all these issues. So I think it's a bit more expensive than just building like they built in the East Block, this boxes, right? But it's not as expensive as, or probably about the same as, the modernist buildings with a lot of steel and a lot of glass and all that. But it depends also on the regional materials that are available. And in so far, our concepts, they differ a bit from where you are and which part of the world.
And building upwards, not a fan above 5 stories, did you?
There will be some buildings higher, but I think, and I'm a little bit influenced by the city of Munich, they came up with that 5 or 6 stories, and that worked out quite well. And one of the other ideas that is related to that is that if you have, say, a square of 2 or 3 square kilometers with 20,000-30,000 people, then you do not start building skyscrapers and let people commute in and out from their sleeping towns, right? But you rather duplicate the same structure. And that's what they did in Munich. So you have a lot of a kind of a polycentric growth, right? You have here a small kind of city, here a small city, but it's a city quarter. City quarter here, city quarter there, and they have all their own central focus points. And some are more specialized in museums, and some more in whatever, bars and restaurants. And that is my idea, because otherwise you get this development, what you can see from the plane. Yeah? It's incredible car traffic. That's at least how I know. Use the landing phase of my plane. I say, okay, let's look at the architecture. And what we see is where the airports are, these are the outskirts. And you very often have developments where one house looks as the other. Hundreds, right? There's not even a restaurant or supermarket. It's just sleeping town or sleeping village. This is ugly. And this is all also against human nature. We want to meet with our fellows, right, and do things. So I think our polycentric idea is much better than what we have today. Today, you have downtown with the big buildings up to skyscrapers for work, and then everybody goes in the car and commutes in and out to sleep, and in the morning the same, the other direction. You're losing 1 hour, 2 hours a day for commuting, and then the downtown is empty at night, and at the sleeping towns nothing happens. It's boring. It's a bad combination.
Did you write it in time to accommodate the new ideas about working from home and things like that? Because obviously, since COVID, some people are going in 1 or 2 days a week that were in an office 5 days a week. So, and that's, I agree with you, that the whole in and out is not only a waste of time and energy and money, but also really decreases your standard of living because you have to sit there packed on a train for an hour and a half a day or whatever. But so is that something you're thinking about that people... I mean, I don't know whether it is ever going to bounce back. Maybe in another couple of years, people will be loving the commute again and wanting to go back in. But I know, I mean, and this is very unscientific, but of my friends that used to work in offices, I don't know a single one of them that now works in their office the whole time. They all work from home sometimes.
Yeah, I think this is a trend that will not be stopped. It will rather be that people have to be in office 1 or 2 days a week, because it's also important to have contact to your fellow workers. But it also depends a bit what you are doing, right? I think what Elon Musk say, you come back to the factory and to the office, or you look for another job.
Did they though? Did people go back?
I don't know, but I think it's some functions, as you said, academics, and if you are really just a desktop worker, it doesn't play a big role where you're doing your work. But for others, more management-oriented positions, it's important to meet people face by face. So I touched that. It can help us because the problem with if you're creating a new city is, well, where are the jobs coming from, right? As you have to basically find an anchor tenant, production factory or whatever, so that you have a critical mass, get a critical mass of jobs that justifies for people to move to the city. Not so if they are remote workers. So, and that's why the digital nomads also were the first to settle in Prospera in Honduras, right? Because for them it's easy. It doesn't play a role where they are. And that plays in our hands because we can say, okay, we are creating an optimal environment from a legal but also from an attractivity standpoint. And people say, oh, then I come, because my job, I have my job. I take my job with me. So this is definitely a support to our case. But I don't think that the whole world will eventually work from home.
There must presumably then be quite a bit of crossover between that aspect and culture, which is one of the other new chapters. What is Free Cities culture? I mean, I certainly couldn't put my finger on it. I mean, here now at the Free Cities conference, there is a massive spectrum of culture as far as I'm concerned. What's your take on it?
Yeah, there is a Free Cities culture coming into existence. But my point was rather that we have to take care of a cultural offer. So normally there was nobody taking care of that because it was just happening from itself, but it took hundreds of years, right? We don't have that time. And what we can see is that holiday resorts are more or less boring, right? If you have one restaurant and then sometimes there's a band playing. So if we want to create really cities, and that is the idea of free cities or free private cities, then we need to push this a bit. And we can do this in two or in several ways. One is that we just hire cultural artists or organizing football tournaments or whatever with all the other communities that are nearby. That also gives us a good relationship to them or a better one. And then you have today so many people who have been canceled for wrong speech, even artists, many of them, or famous professors, you can invite all them, hey, hold a lecture, or you can invite the artist to come, right? So we can offer you a safe haven as a free private city for an independent thinking artist who is cancelled by the mainstream, even in Western countries. You know, this is happening more and more by the day. And this is a chance for us. And then you have to take care that a local culture is coming into existence. And that means people... we are not hiring bands as a free private city operator, but we can say there's a venue. You can hire it for cheap money in the beginning until something has established. And we would say it's allowed to have live music there in this part of the town or whatever. And so you push a bit this cultural thing, because otherwise it just takes too long to develop by itself. That's at least my thinking. And then on the other hand, which goes more into your question, is, yeah, there is a kind of a free city culture, and we have developing, and we have had this book contest where we were asking people how the life in free private cities could look like if we had free private cities. And more than 100 people all over the world were sending in their short stories. And I think the best 20 of them made it into the book Road to Liberty by the Free Cities Foundation. And I especially like the story of Sebastian Grelle, which was the winning story, where he describes a city where each quarter was populated by, he called them the tech achievers, then the empirists, then the nature lovers. And so every quarter had their own architecture, they had their own culture, they had their own ideas, and even some people were living a second life in one of the other quarters. And I like the idea, because this is exactly what we want to create. We want to give people, and that's why there is not much zoning and not much master planning, because we say, hey, you just ally with like-minded people under the umbrella of the free private city operator, which is basically protecting life, liberty, and property. But within that framework, you do as you choose. And then this is going to happen. I'm relatively sure that like-minded people will find together. One real-world example. When we had our project in West Africa, which eventually failed because of political change, but we had already... we were already far advanced and had a law passed by parliament. We had a territory secured. And then some people from more, I would say, from the alternative yoga scene, they approached me and say, is it possible for us to make our own village there? We have same type of people. We want to do our things, living in harmony with nature, a lot of wood and all these meditation and yoga. But I said, this is not a problem at all. We have enough space. You form your village there. And as long as you sign the contract and respect the rules, you do your own thing there. And that can happen.
What's interesting is just, I had a conversation this morning with, they're called Regen Tribe. They're here speaking, and they're very much into regenerative neighborhoods, they call them. Mm-hmm. But they certainly come from that world. What they said that was interesting was, and I don't know whether you've ever thought about this before, but when you look at the evolution of many cities, what you notice, because this happened to me where I lived in London, Shoreditch was a part of London which was basically falling into disrepair. At one point, because rents were cheap, the artist moved in. And then over a process of 25 years, it turned into one of the most expensive places to live. Because whatever it is about artists and making things cool, and then, you know... So there is an evolutionary cycle to these kind of things. And I don't know whether it's good or bad. I could argue that it's probably not necessarily good, because what actually ends up happening is people just buy the lifestyle, in inverted commas. And then obviously it's not real anymore. It's not real. It's a mimic. It's a fake version of that original thing. So does that happen in free private cities, or because you have to let the thing happen, don't you?
Yes, we don't know, Tim. This is something we cannot plan, and we do not want to plan. this is also unplanned, right? I mean, especially these artists was going to lofts, right? Old factory buildings. Yeah, yeah. Nobody had ever planned that. So we, and we are not going to plan factory buildings so that they eventually are emptied. So, and we are not going to plan them anyhow, right? This is, these are the factory owners, the landowners, they will do that. But I think such things will happen. What, because people, for example, what we have seen in the past is that cities, when cities were growing, successful cities were growing, and then they were coming closer to the factory areas, and then there were all kinds of disputes, and then it's factories eventually said, okay, let's sell our land because we get much more and move a little bit far out. And that can happen again, right? This is a natural development, and then two things are possible. Either you keep the factory buildings and make something fancy, or you tear them all down and build apartment houses or whatever. So that is really something we don't know. We also don't, let me make another example. Gibraltar was once interesting when I thought, okay, what is the best place in Europe to settle? Eventually I thought it's Monaco, but Gibraltar was in the choice. And they made a lot of regulation that is business friendly in a particular way. And it turned out that Gibraltar became the mecca of the gambling industry, online gaming and all that. Nobody planned that, right? It was just developing, and because they had the best regulatory things, and other people, probably they wanted to attract other industries, but it turned out that that was the thing. And that is often the case with city planning, that people think, okay, now I'm the big guru and my ideas should prevail. And then this master planning is a kind of totalitarian order, right? And we want exactly the opposite. We want that people decide for themselves. So we are making very limited planning, but that also means we cannot foresee the future, and we don't want that. It's too many parameters in our world. We cannot just tell you, okay, what's going to happen.
What about you on a personal level? On a personal level, if you say Monaco was run like that, and over the next few years, a community of heavy metal musicians moved in next door. Presumably, that's going to piss you off. You know, like what are the rules you can lay down?
Like it wouldn't necessarily piss me off, because I was a hardcore band drummer for many years, hardcore punk and stuff
past.
Like that.
In what the about past. The guy now who's banging the drums every night?
Yeah, though? But this is indeed a problem, and this is a noise issue, and this is something which we call emissions, technical term, right? And you have the right to some tranquility, some silence. That is part of your property. And if it's violated, you can enforce that. And that is why some zoning is necessary. So what happened in today's world would also happen in our free private city. If you have a heavy metal band and want to make your training exercises and probing all that, you do that in the area where the heavy industry is.
Heavy metal district.
heavy metal, heavy industry.
Brilliant. Okay. Another one of your titles that you just mentioned earlier was ethics. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the ethics of free private cities. Yeah. What? Okay.
So this was a gap that was this in this discussion, because it's something that people say, yeah, this classic liberal or libertarian thing, this is all good, but it's not enough to keep a society over a long period of time. It's just not enough, right? You have to add some religion or some moral or ethics foundation to make this happen. And I think there's some truth to that, but on the other hand, that is not a function of the original liberalism. And that was, Ludwig von Mises said that. The classic liberalism, or what we today would say libertarianism, that is enabling more wealth and more freedom. But if these are good things, that is not the decision, right? It could be that the society says we don't want that. We want to live poor, but in closer contact to nature. And that's their decision. And that is a voluntary cooperation. And there's nobody on the outside who can say, I condemn this. As long as cooperation is voluntary, there's absolutely nothing that can be said against it. And unless people can leave, right? So what we have here is, for example, a free private city that has a society that enables a very large economic and personal freedom. But the people decide, because they're so wealthy, let's stop making babies. We don't want children any longer. What happens? Well, they, unless they're immortal, they die out, right? And the other group that is more whatever, right, but more totalitarian, but they say it's our duty to reproduce, they will prevail, right? So I said, okay, that is a good point. And so we should maybe put some, let's say, ethical guidelines that can be given to our children that have proven over time. And the family is one of them, right? I'm not disclosing my recommendations here because it can, even a free privacy, it can only be recommendations. We will not force anybody to any ethics. But like good clothing, I said, if we are dressing well, or if a relatively large group of influential people is dressing well, then others will copy that. And it's a bit the same with ethics, right? If you say, hey, you shouldn't marry, start a family, because then you're living in the past, future, and present at the same time. You should honor your parents for that reason. You should help the people who deserve it and the people who cannot help themselves. And there are some rules that are necessary for a society to be stable over a long period of time. Over a short period of time, you don't need them. But for a long period of time, you need them. And they have to be transported to the next generation. And that is because we are talking about, I think the two of us, we have discussed Venice, right? Yes. 1,100 years of existence, independent existence. Yes. Well, to remain for 1,100 years, it's not enough to have freedom of contract, let's put it that way.
There's no thought of baking in the ethics to the contract then, so to speak.
In a way it is, because you, for example, what is the basic of the contract is the golden rule, right? You do not unto others what you don't want them unto do to you. And then you have the reciprocity that all rights, they are also, my rights are also your rights. So I have not more rights and you don't have less rights. So I'm on an equal footing. So this is incorporated or baked into the contract in a way. So you have this, I would say, golden rule, reciprocity, non-aggression principle is already in there. And so you're covering already a lot. But I think it was not enough for the long term. And again, you might see this differently. But I put a chapter in the book, and I made even a proposal for 15 rules. And then you can, again, say, okay, no, we don't need that. Or maybe he's not so wrong here, maybe. So I think this is, and will ever be, a subject to discussion. But I thought that something was missing when just creating new societies on a contractual basis, because there are some behavior that you cannot put in a contract, like marry and start a family. I mean, it's just, I can't make this an obligation.
Right? But the free part of free private cities has to incorporate the non-aggression principle, the golden rule. This is the free part of the free private cities, right?
No,
every free private city has to really have that backbone.
Yes, I think backbone. The free freedom backbone, right? The freedom means that you're not forced to things that you don't want to do, and that means you cannot force others to do that. So that is automatically a given. And if you are violating that principle, which means putting force upon others, you are breaking the contract and you will kick you out. So automatically, I think free private cities will attract a certain type of person that is not running to the state or other big brothers and saying, take care for me and take the money away from others and give it to me. Right, these type of people, they know there's no ground for them in free private cities. So you have a pre-selection, but the majority of people, they will probably not think about those things and don't care. They just go there because there's a job there, or like in Honduras, it's safer and better infrastructure. And for those people, I think it's important that you also say there's a certain ethics behind that. And you can also, for example, teach in school or in voluntary lectures, say these are the principle of free private cities, and the golden rule is one of them, that we all have equal rights. That means I cannot just put my will over the will of another. That's an important information. And why have the societies failed? That was always the same, because a certain group of people thought, okay, now we are the rulers, and we make all kinds of ideas work, our ideas, how the world should work. And that's always ending in disaster. And in so far, this is a very important, I would say, insight. And it's also part of the ethics to transport that knowledge. I think this is very important, because we have seen what progressive people in education have done. They're destroying millennia of civilization within decades now, and that can happen again. So I think it's our task to at least tell people why free private cities are what they are, and for what reason we have limited the city operator to the protection of life, liberty, and property.
There are some, what you have updated, as you mentioned earlier, projects in the free cities spectrum. I'm thinking ZA. I mean, when you first wrote the book, ZAs were a thing, but there weren't any being built. Is that right?
Yeah, it was so that I was already approached in 2016. The book was first published in 2018. So while I was writing the book, I was approached because I was holding some speeches in microstate conferences and things like that. So one group that set up what is today Cede Prospera, had an other name back then, they were approaching me and said, look, Titos, the problem with the Cede law is this is a top-down approach, right? There's a big governor called technical secretary, he's making all the rules. And then there's a state commission that approves the rules. There's zero participation, there's zero private governance. Can we implement your private governance idea into the Cede model? And I said, yeah, of course. And I looked at the Cede law and say, wow, this is giving a lot of autonomy. There's an agreement of coexistence mentioned. That's my citizens' contract. And I said, yes, I'm in, right? I like your project. I want to support you guys. And I invested and then even became closer, finally, chief legal officer to making that happen. But it took us until the end of 2017 that the first Cede, which is today Cede Prospera, was approved. And then 2018, my book came out, and Cede Prospera used some of the elements I'm proposing, like the citizens contract is a very integral part of the system, but it's a hybrid system. You still have the old technical secretary system, and then there's a city council now. So it's a little bit a mixture between a charter city with a charter and a free private city with a contract. So it's both, actually, a strange hybrid, but that has historical reasons. And other things were that basically there's guarantee, a legal stability guarantee in the contract. You have the idea that a private company is doing basically all the administration. The government of Honduras at that time said, but not the police and taxes should be collected by officials, not by this private entity. But this is more or less the only thing that isn't privatized, but it's done by city officials, if you want. So I would say that is a lot of things were happening while I was writing the book, and some things were already there. Some of my ideas were taken over, and to a relatively large degree. So if people ask me now, is there a free private city already existing? I said no. But you have these interesting Cede models that are have elements of it, and they're coming relatively close to it. And then you have Dubai International Financial Center also coming relatively close to it. And so the interesting thing is that the second Cede Morazan, they took over these ideas, more or less, from the, say, the prospect at the city council and the contract and all that. And only the third, say, they made something completely different and said, let's just say the law of Delaware is applicable, and that's it. But they are only one, it's a one company, say, they're only producing, seafood or something for export. So the interesting thing is that while I was writing the book, these things were unfolding in the real world. And now we have had a second CEDE type of autonomy in this West African country that unfortunately failed. But there are a lot of other groups, including my company, discussing with several governments now at the same time. So if you ask me, will it happen? I say, yeah, eventually it's unstoppable. It's unstoppable. Even if you say it's not exactly a free private city, but the idea that there's a private company governing a special zone on behalf of the government, of the host nation, and they give people a contract, I think this is not stoppable.
I think when I was talking to Andreas in Montenegro, he was talking about the fact that the next big part of this process will be economic zones turning into places where people can live in the economic mm-hmm. zones. Is that fair to say? It's the next obvious evolution.
It is.
Because it's already in place. And it's easy to imagine. I think when you're talking to governments about these kind of things, it's one thing to say, let's go from naught to free private city. It's a much easier thing to say, look, you've got this zone where they make their own rules. So why can't some of the people live there? You know,
because so far the governments wrote in their laws that people should not live there.
Of course, but why?
Everybody can see that it's working much better in their country. No, but you're right. Joke aside, this is definitely evolutionary, the next logical step, right? You started with, this is also something I learned from Andreas, right? It started really with free trade zones, free trade ports, free ports, right? Then you had some light manufacturing, then heavy industries, and then suddenly, which was considered totally new and unique, services in a special economic zone. Why that, right? Tourism zones, even. And then the latest development was the international financial centers, which started in Dubai, but now they have copycats in Abu Dhabi, in Kazakhstan, and somewhere else. And there's exactly this development happened exactly there that you described, that they first started with international financial center banking and all these stuff. And then they said, okay, people could live there. But the people said, hey, I don't want Sharia law, not only for banking, I also don't want it to family law. And I said, okay, let's make a common law-based family law for the DIFC, for the Dubai International Financial Center. And now they have restaurants, art galleries, and everything. So it's becoming a city. And that is, as you said, doesn't make sense. You have a great economy here. Why commute? People should live there. And then you have this, what also is a natural development. People want a certain set of rules, especially expats coming with some expectations, the high potentials. They coming and saying, hey, we want some special rules for us. And then the reasonable host nations say, hey, why not? We want those people here. And I think so. It's even if I wasn't there with my coming now from the freedom side, right, and not from the special economic zone side, we are now meeting in the middle. Even if I wasn't there, I think this was going to happen. It probably would take some years longer to come to the idea to make a private governance system based on a contract, because this is really new. But it's more or less natural in the rest of our world. Service contracts are nothing totally extravagant, right? It's daily business, but not in our system of living together yet. And I can tell you that the idea that, I'm talking to governments on a regular basis, the idea that a private company is managing this on behalf of the host nation's government and giving contracts to nationals and foreigners as well is acceptable. It's acceptable to them. And they say, oh, that makes sense. So I think it's coming. It's not, we are not going to stop that.
Mm. What about some of the other projects then that you've had to update? I'm thinking seasteading.
Seasteading, we had this incident in Thailand, which is a bit in a history of attempts to get freedom from nation states. They end up in violent violation of existing laws by the states, right? But that's how it is. And that's why I recommend, we have seen it in Lebanon recently, that's why I recommend you better make an agreement with the host nation instead of going secession or saying we are totally independent or it's terra nullius.
What happened in Thailand?
Yeah, the seasteaders, the first seasteader, Chad Elwatkowski, with the first product of Ocean Builders, a seastead was anchored outside of the 12-mile zone of Thailand.
Right.
And from time to time, they got food from the mainland, but they lived there for a couple of months. And suddenly, then the Thai Navy said, that's treason, it's against sovereignty, and they claimed it was inside their territorial borders. You still have this exclusive economic zone outside of 12 miles, but it hasn't much meaning in this circumstance. So they lied, right? They lied. They said it was inside, but Ocean Builders have published the location, so it's clearly outside. Not much, but it's clearly outside. And so they towed it away and destroyed it and said that a treason and death penalty, a threat and all that. So the people had heard, on the seastead, the couple had heard of this before by some sources, so they could escape. But that shows you that it's a little bit like the Minerva project, I think it was in the 70s, out of off the coast of Australia, where they had a reef which was basically underwater, was 1 or 2 meters underwater, and they claimed land by putting a lot of sand. It was a very expensive undertaking, I think 100 million or so at that time. And the neighboring states didn't like that. So eventually Tonga claimed that land, that it's ours for historical reasons, right? And nobody helped them. So because Australia and New Zealand also didn't want to have a new country there. The same as the Rose Island in the Adriatic Sea. There's a Netflix movie. They all had the right on their side. And I think this is the same with Lebanon today. The legal position of Lebanon is consistent, right? They say this is clearly what Serbia is not claiming that land and Croatia neither, right? But the Croatians say, well, we don't care. But don't make a real argument. They just don't do it. And the same happened in Minerva with Tonga, the Navy, the small Navy sent a patrol boat. Rose Island was destroyed by the Italian Navy. Seasteading was destroyed by the Thai Navy. So we can now complain about that and maybe start a big procedural trial at the International Sea Court in Hamburg, where the question is, do we have legal standing? Probably not, right? So the seasteaders now think, no, we have learned from that. We have now a flag. We're going with the flag of a country, so we make an agreement with the country. They have kind of agreement with Panama now. I think this is the right way to go, right? Not confrontation, but just say agreement with countries, because they have the bigger sticks at the end of the day, and they don't care if you are right legally or not.
Well, interestingly, of course, as well, in Prospera, they have now a problem with the government, even though they had an agreement with the government. But what's also interesting is they have a pretty watertight legal argument.
Exactly.
Which is much better. Yeah.
This is much better. And that is two things. One, it's still there because they have this legal protection. Second, they have legal standing. They could sue Honduras in front of the International Court or International Arbitration Court in Washington. And they could only do this because they had this agreement, right? Mm. So in so far, I would say it is a clear showpiece that worked even in difficult times. Because otherwise, I would say if they had no agreement with Honduras and were claiming they were outside territorial waters, they would just say, you know what, we send the army and then you disappear. And in this case now they're still abstaining from sending the army because they know, okay, actually they have a legal position which is even in our constitution, and they have a law and they have all kinds of guarantees, and very, very difficult to get rid of the existing zones. And I think this is also something which we all are watching and seeing. I mean, I helped also creating the legal framework, but the basic groundwork was done by the Hondurans themselves by saying, okay, even if the law is withdrawn, you will have another 10 years, and unless you have a contract saying more than 10 years. And they had an international treaty conducted with Cuba, it's saying the cities would have 50 years. They did well. The Honduran founders of the cities, they did well. They were all jurists. They were know what they were doing. They were all Hondurans. They knew their country. They knew that can happen. The next government will try to destroy everything. And so they put very good protections in place.
I mean, I suppose it's at the end of the day as well, it comes down to basic human nature in a way. In the eyes of the state, let's say, if the state thinks it owns somewhere and you go in and say, no, it's mine, of course they're going to have to do something about it. That's how the mafia works in a way, isn't it? It's like, whereas if you go and say hello and say, look, we want to do this, how do you feel about this? Let's come to an agreement. Then you're in much better standing. And now, as we can see, you know, and this is the great thing about, I think, the Free Cities movement is, every year that passes by, you get more information on what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see. It's really good to see, because you actually are building up a thesis on how this thing stuff works.
And that's exactly why I wanted to include this in my new edition of the book, The First Experience, to learn from. And we have a lot of experience from Honduras. We have some experience from seasteading. We have Liberland. We have even NEOM, the state driven projects.
Which is that?
This is the Saudi Arabia. This is huge. They sell it as the biggest project in the world today. It's as huge as Belgium.
Hold on a minute. How have I not heard about this? How do you say that?
NEOM. It's called NEOM. So originally the idea was this, of this new crown prince, right, who's now the new ruler. He said, let's create a part of Saudi Arabia which has more liberal rules so that we can really make something, should be totally open to business and innovation and totally sustainable and all these things. And that, for me, is okay, they want to compete with Dubai and the other stuff, and that is only good for us. Yeah? If governments compete for you, that is the subtitle of my book, that's happening here. Mm. But then obviously they get some backlash against the conservatives in Saudi Arabia. And so until today, you have not heard what exactly their rules are. I know that behind the scenes, they're struggling. The conservative and the more open, modern people in Saudi Arabia are struggling about what should be the rules of this thing, right? Should you be stoned to death for adultery or not? Probably not very attractive if they keep it, but that is their choice. But they have immense firepower, financial firepower. They have huge portions of land. Then have this rather dystopian idea about the line, the city.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. This is one part of it, but they have so much space. It's only one part of it.
I didn't realize the line was part of it.
The line is part of it.
Right.
But this is a very interesting project because we can see if they carve out a piece of their country to create something new, it's okay, then let's do it in other countries as well. And this time we do it in the free private city model because it's working better than the dystopian line. Right, but we will see. I mean, this is very, very interesting. Therefore, I put it in my book, and I didn't make too much about it because I'm not an insider, but it's also interesting to watch it from the outside. And I think what we will see is that more and more things will be tried out. And then, as you said, we can learn from that. The learning curve will be steep. And people who are born today or in 5 years' time, for them it's like Bitcoin is normal and such free cities are normal. And that is a good thing.
I think what's interesting about the fact that that's happening in Saudi Arabia is it's one thing to have an economic zone in a country that's already The zone is not that different from the country. It's just some legislation. But in Saudi, you've got a very strict, hardline culture, let's say. I'm not even sure it's a culture. Like, the guy's in charge, basically. So if you create, obviously, theoretically, if they create a more liberal place, it'll drain, you would imagine, in the end, it'll just drain all the people from the... I mean, history kind of does show that people don't like to live under authoritarian regimes. So,
but here's the thing. They get a lot of goodies for that, right? Which they may not get in NEOM.
Right. Such as? You mean like social...
Who knows? I mean, this is maybe so attractive that nevertheless the good people will leave.
What do they get in under the regime, though?
I think they get free healthcare, free pension, free everything.
Right. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I spoke to the guys that designed Morazan. We had them on the podcast the other week, and I was talking to them about the line, and they told me in not too many words why it was a terrible idea to have this long line of things. Like, it was like, wait a minute, they had so many questions. How are you going to live in this thing? You know, what are you, you know... and I'm not, I don't know, maybe it's someone's idea, obviously.
This anti-human, we destroying nature and therefore should be gathered on a very small place.
Yeah, but a line? Like, it's kilometers long.
Yeah,
as well.
The idea is, there's a video, and the idea, I think you have all amenities within 10 minutes of your part of the line, yeah. Right? And then you have a train going through the whole line, yes. And then you can go to the airport or things like that.
But who lives, like, if you think about life, who lives in a line? People live like, you know, they go out from themselves.
Exactly,
you know?
That's why we have developed, I think the mistake in this thinking, it's again a modernist thing, is that we are destroying nature, right? No, we are creating our environment. That's what we always have done. We are part of nature. And it is so. And if you think that nature should be here and humans should be there, that's not how our world works. And that is the mistake of the line conception. But I say let the market decide. They want to attract 9 million people. Yeah, let's see if they get more than 9,000.
One of the problems in Saudi Arabia, though, is living with nature is not an easy task in Saudi Arabia. It's very hot. It's sandy. There's not a lot of, you know... Arguably, how would you design a place to live in the middle of the desert? It might look something like, I suppose, Dubai.
Yeah, but look, if you have cheap energy, you can make it an oasis.
Yeah,
you can make
it
very green.
Yeah.
Look at parts of Dubai. You can, and especially Saudis, they love this extravagant things. And they have mountains too. Right? They even want to create a ski resort.
Create a ski resort?
In NEOM.
How? Oh, you mean under...
They have some high mountains where it's obviously some snow there.
Really?
From time to time.
God, yeah. I didn't know that. In Saudi has snow-capped mountains.
Yeah, or at least it's so cold that you can produce snow.
I thought you meant they would put a lid on it. I put a lid on the mountain and create a microclimate.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Dubai also has a ski resort.
Exactly.
Right? But, I mean... For me, the most interesting question is not design or architecture or skiing. It's the legal system. And we have even made a request saying, we want to relocate our headquarters to your place. What is the legal framework? And we can't say yet. So that's a problem. They're starting building without having... I wouldn't come if this weren't clear.
Do you know anything about who's paying for it and how they're going to... get the money back? Is it purely the family with all, you know,
they have allocated several billions, and I think it's the state of Saudi Arabia.
And do you know why? Purely because they want to...
Because the new leader, I think, has seen that what we are telling all the time, it's too difficult to change a whole country. But if you carve out a small area, it's easier. They can't do small things in Saudi Arabia, so they carved out Belgium size. But it's smaller than the rest of the country. And they say, let's, and I think he's a reasonable guy. He said, okay, what I want to do a kind of a Singapore. It's not working because this is not working with our culture, but let's create this small city type or smaller thing. And there we will have all kinds of easements and other rules that make a Singapore slash Dubai type development possible.
I know what you mean about they can't do anything small there. I worked in Qatar once when setting up their, or helping to set up their natural history unit of a filming natural history unit. And we were doing some filming out in the desert and we needed power. And I remember just saying, we need power out here kind of thing for these shoots that we were doing. Next thing I know, they'd laid like 3 kilometers of cable under the sand. And it's like, you know, I was thinking more like, let's get some big batteries out there and stuff. But it was just like, no. And it all happened so fast. It's like, yeah, we can do that. It's a very different way of thinking. And I think partly because there's a lot of money there. There's absolutely a lot of money. It's a can-do place in many ways. So,
It's coming from another angle, right? We are basically the small guys who love freedom and say, hey, what can we do? And then there are the guys that have a whole state behind them and a lot of money. And they're coming to the same conclusion, in a way, right? Because they will probably have the idea top down. There will be a governor of NEOM. He will make all the decisions, and there's no other guys participating. But then if our free cities and free private cities are popping up here and there, I tell you, the world will watch. They will say, hey, what they are doing, how they are doing it. It's not bad. Why not a private company? Things like that will happen naturally. And we are seeing now, we are not merging yet, but I think it will come. And on places on Earth where you probably wouldn't have expected that, on the other hand, you have all kinds of special zones already in the United Arab Emirates. They were one of the pioneers of special economic zones. So it's not so surprising that in this part of the world there's more competition for these zones. And so far, that's the good thing, that the world is not just the West, but it's a big place with all kinds of cultures and all kinds of different backgrounds. So we are pragmatic and opportunistic when it comes to locations for our free private cities, because we have to. Right?
Do you think in places like Saudi Arabia, the state is realizing that, are they looking for a way out of their own governance model, or are they looking for a way to just attract business? Is it that people
think, I don't know, maybe it's just to attract business to become even more known in the world, but maybe it's also an attempt to reform their own society through the back door.
Yeah, I do wonder. I mean, I don't know, it's an interesting thought, because you know,
I'm offering this to governments and say, in our small zone, when I'm negotiating about that, right, it's always about creating win-win-win. The win is, of course, for us. The other win is for the government. And the third win is for the people, the population of the host nation. So, and I said, look, we can try out new things. And if you like some of those things, why not taking it over for your country? It can be as trivial as a electronic land registry, or blockchain-based transaction proof, or whatever. So you can take it over for free. And this is a bit what I'm already promoting, right? And I think maybe the Crown Prince has had same idea, say, let's try out new things, and if it's successful, we say, hey, why don't we change Saudi Arabia in this or that regard, like they did?
I mean, it's a well-known, and I have first-hand experience of this, that many people that live in that part of the world have a particular way of living there, but when they come abroad, their ideals change, let's say. So maybe it's like, well, you know, I would imagine that as someone who was high up in Saudi society, you would know that you can't just change things overnight. You would know that yourself, exactly. Even if you were a reformist.
Yeah.
Because there is so much ingrained in that system. But you could see something like this certainly as a step in that direction. And if that's what you were after, and we've seen many Middle Eastern countries change drastically in the last 50 years. And, you know, many of those were on account of somebody in high up in one of the families going to study abroad and coming back with new ideas and saying, do you know what, I quite like this, why don't we try this, you know?
Yeah, and also because these are monarchies, right? They have a long-term horizon and they have a long term to rule. So there's no election coming up in 4 years, so they can make these longer term projects. So this is one advantage that such societies have.
Last question then. We're on a bit of a time. Yeah, we're already over time. Typical. And this is a really interesting one because I've thought myself about this one a number of times, and it's a very difficult question to answer because you're basically trying to think what would most people think is the right thing to do, I would imagine. And that is, how do you deal with the situation we had during the pandemic? Do you lock down? Do you not lock down? Do you say to everyone, look, you know, this is what it is. Do you incorporate it in the contract? Probably from now on, it's the kind of thing you probably would incorporate in a contract because we've all seen it happen in real life. So how would a free private city deal with the idea of a pandemic?
Yeah, it's in the contract would be a clause that in case of a danger from external or force majeure, there could be special measures. And even if this clause wasn't there, if my obligation as a contractual city operator is protection of life, liberty, and property, then people would sue me if I wouldn't do anything if there was a threat, right? And then you have a relatively established mechanism how this works, which is a proportionality principle. You say, okay, first, is there a risk, right? Like COVID pandemic, first, is there a risk? It wasn't sure. In 2020, probably answer yes. Yeah? It seems so people in Italy are all dying and on the cruise ships dying more than usual. So probably we have a problem here. And then the next question is, what you do, has this really the effect of, is this effective? Is it useful, right? If I have a mask mandate and then I know it doesn't help me, it's useless. So I wouldn't be justified to do that. And then third is it's proportional, it's a balancing. Do I do more damage than good with these measures? And these are classical legal techniques when it comes to state a monopoly of force power in certain circumstances. So what we would have here is a purely contractual relationship between you as a citizen in a free private city and me as a city operator. And let's assume we have two neighbors, Annie and Peter. And Annie is totally frightening, saying we will all going to die from this COVID. And Peter says, no, it's just the flu. It's made up by the media. Do nothing. She said, lock down everything. And he says, do nothing. So people would sue me both. They can, because we have contracts, right? So I'm caught between a rock and a hard place, but it's not a bad thing compared to the states, because I really have to take care that my decision is balanced. And I write this in the book, in the new edition, that we would probably in the first time have said, okay, it's dangerous, so we would at least recommend that people don't gather together. It would be no gathering under the free air, what we can influence. And then if the school wants to close, it's up to the school, right? We are not interfering in that because we don't know too much. But then in the second phase, when we had this great Barrington Declaration and first insights that, yeah, it's real, but it's not a big danger for young and healthy people. It's more a danger for the old and people who have illnesses before. And then you would say, okay, we can then make a special protection measures for these people, but leave the rest of the people alone. And then I would also probably could win before a court or arbitration court against any, Because any, of course, would say, no, you have to lock down everything and everybody must wear a mask, even outside. And then I could say, look, here are Stanford University professors saying this and that, and here's evidence that, this is enough. A mask doesn't really help, and therefore there will be no mask mandate. You're free to use a mask. You're free to vaccinate you with whatever you want. And I think then at the end, I would probably not have done lockdowns, I would not have done mask mandates, and not forced unvaccinated people out of their jobs or out of the restaurants or bars. This is, now in hindsight, it's easier to say, right?
Because for sure.
At the beginning, it wasn't sure how dangerous this was. And maybe we have another virus coming in some years that is really dangerous. Mm-hmm. But then again, you have these measures. Is it effective? Is it useful? And is it proportional to the damage that is done? That, and this balancing act was not done by our governments. They just locked it down. They didn't care about that people were losing their jobs, that they were, that the children were not going to school and had problems with their developments and all. They didn't care. It just was political power. And they would not basically stop or withdraw the lockdowns, because if then people died, the press would have said it's because of you relieved the lockdowns too early. So they better are in place because you don't see the other people dying at home or being basically frustrated at home. And this is not going to happen in a free private city, because people would sue me, and rightly so, right? Because in case of doubt, it's for freedom. And that is a principle. This is baked into the contract. Mm. So this is the situation. So it's not I have basically the receipt for all problems and it's not a problem. No. It's always a balancing act. But what we have seen in the reality with COVID was that there was no balancing act at all. Mm. They were not calculating their damage against the usefulness, which just said that it's just ordered. In the beginning, they said, and if we don't do this, millions and millions of people will die. Okay, but then after you see that people didn't die in the millions, then why didn't you change then, right? And so if you are permanently under fire from your own residents to do more, to do less, you are forced that you balance it out. And I think this is the big advantage of free private cities.
And like you say, there's an underlying principle of freedom, which you don't really get in the UK anyway.
It's not there any longer in Western states, unfortunately.
What about the idea, though, that I see how the legal system can act in everyone's best interest here, like rather than someone in the state just saying, yeah, just do this. We say, well, how would this work legally? Like, why doesn't the lady in your example, why isn't it put on her the onus to look after herself? So, for example, if she thinks this is a terrible virus that is going to kill everyone, that's cool. But stay indoors then.
That would have been our argument, right? You can say, okay, if you are afraid, then you put all masks and all clothing that you want and vaccinate you with whatever you want. You stay at home. It's not your problem if others go out, right? But this is, of course, then something to a degree she or her lawyer would have argued, that this is basically my freedom. No, inflicted because I cannot move freely.
This is interesting though, isn't it?
Because everybody is forced to be vaccinated, I can move freely.
But exactly, does everyone have the right to walk freely in a pandemic? Like legally speaking, you would have thought the only people that have the
legally,
right to
legally
walk...
speaking, yes, you have, because it's the only thing because it's your body, right? If you want to go out and die, that's your choice.
Yes, that's what I mean. But,
yes.
Works the other way around though, doesn't it? It's her choice to not die.
No. This would have been our argument. Yeah. But the thing is that She would have said, if everybody had a mask, I could go out, and so you should. And also, it's helping all us, right?
Yes.
And one of the things was people saying, if you're vaccinated, then you cannot basically then inflict others, right? Which was not true,
yeah,
but that was the claim, right? And let's assume there is a disease which is killing everyone quickly, right? And like the plague. One third of population died out. So if this was the case, then I think it's justified to restrict free movement. And you say, because you are infected, everybody that comes in contact with you will die. And you will die next week. And they will then die a week after. But this is an extreme situation which was not given here. Right? And so far, it's freedom of movement. If you take the risk to go out and be infected on COVID and then maybe die or whatever, that's your choice.
Yeah. Right. But also, I've got the distinct feeling that if it was as serious as the plague was back in the day, people would be making the choice to stay at home. There would be absolutely no... And if they realised masks didn't work, they wouldn't be saying everyone needs to wear a mask. They'd be like, I ain't wearing a mask because it didn't do anything. You know.
The market, again, is telling the truth. If COVID was really, really so dangerous that it was promoted as, people would, on the black market, get vaccination stuff. Now, what they did get on the black market in reality was passes saying they were vaccinated despite they weren't.
Yeah, yes,
the
yeah.
market shows you, yes. if there was a real danger, people would pay a lot of money to get the vaccination.
Yes.
Now people paid a lot of money to get a vaccination passport without being vaccinated.
Yeah, yeah.
The market shows you that there was no real danger.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting. I too wonder if the next time there's a pandemic, which I don't even know why I'm saying that, because it's not as if pandemics are just, you know, going to be coming all the time. But it would be ironic if it actually did really kill a lot of people. I know, you know, and we were all like, oh, don't worry about it this time. It's going to be fine. And then,
And the other thing is that a pandemic that is so deadly that it's immediately killing, that it's not spreading a lot, right? Because people are dying too quickly. So it's very difficult to understand that it's more the disease, and then you die after several months. These things are dangerous then, indeed. But you are right. We would then behave differently.
I think so. I think definitely. I found the whole situation. Do you have your own personal opinion on why states almost universally did the whole thing terribly? And, you know, I think I told you this experience I had before, which was after the pandemic, well, sort of at the back end of the pandemic. I run expeditions in my other life, and we had an expedition going out to Mongolia. It was the first time anyone could travel, so we were like, cool, let's do it. They had fewer restrictions. And we had a policy. We put in place a policy. No one obviously signed anything, but I just said, look, our policy is we are not considering this as a deadly thing anymore, because we know it's not, especially if you're fit and healthy and young, which everyone was. But we'll deal with every situation as it comes, right? And what actually happened in reality, because someone actually did get COVID on the trip, because we were testing.
Mm-hmm.
Someone got a sniffly nose, and I said, look, what we're going to do is we're going to test so that we know. And we had one person on the trip who was very neurotically against getting COVID. And I ended up, as the leader, ended up accommodating them, even though everyone else was cool with it. Because what happened was, everyone was cool and didn't really care, because they didn't care to try and impose that we did nothing about it, even though that was probably the correct thing to do. But the person that was neurotic about it ended up dictating to the whole group. And I've got a feeling that happened a lot in a lot of countries,
yes,
as well, on a macro scale.
This is the answer to your question, right? It's only a small minority. And the problem for a politician is, he has no clue if this is dangerous or not, right? But he wants to be reelected, so
yes.
He has to show activity. And it's much better, and even in wars or crisis, is ideal for politicians, because they can show that they have a reason of existence. They say, no, I'm taking the lead and I'm protecting you, the big protector. And then if he would be a reasonable person saying, no, it's not necessary, like in your group, right? It's not necessary to do those things. Then a small minority would just cry, yeah, and people are dying because of you, and the press would love that. And then another problem, all countries around you are doing the same thing. Yeah. So this is a big pressure, which is reinforcing itself. That's a problem. It's a real problem. And it's, thank God, a handful of countries have done differently, like Sweden, so we can now compare the data, right, for the next time. But this is a problem with politics, and that's why I also hope that with a big, I would say, portfolio or of free cities, we can escape that pressure to do everything the same like all other countries do it.
Well, obviously as well, contracts will solve that exact thing. And because in my case, I was in a situation where I had to make a decision, and I knew that the majority didn't care, but the minority did. And the minority were going to kick up a real stink for the majority if we didn't just go along with them. And I think that's a very common political situation as well. But yeah, if I had a contract that everyone signed.
Yeah, and this is the good thing. You can always say, hey, in the contract says I'm not obliged to do that.
Right? You need a third
and
party.
And I, as an operator, can say, I would love to do the same as you, host nation, but I can't because of the contracts, right? It's a little bit like this crypto signal that we say it's basically end-to-end encrypted, and even the operator cannot get into that. It's a little bit the same with our contracts. I can say, I cannot change the contract. I'm sorry. I would like to do the same lockdowns as you, host nation, but unfortunately, the contracts doesn't allow me.
It's taking out the human element of the decision-making after the point of making the decision.
Political pressure by being loud and running to the journalists. And
which is, So why hasn't, just quickly, why hasn't this happened in the past? Why haven't people done this in the past? Because you could have had contracts.
Yeah, I think in the past there wasn't there wasn't a situation that all countries in the world would basically behave the same, right? Because they were not so connected with each other.
No, I mean the contracts. Like, why is it that the idea of a contract with the city provider, say, in a city situation, why did that not arise already?
I think because they were always coming from that ruler, and the ruler is then replaced by the second level autocrats, which were then the traders and the businessmen and the people and the guilds in the cities, right? And they took then power, and over time more and more people could have a say in that. There are some areas where you have those contractual systems, like with the pirates, the official pirates. They were mandated by the crown to rob Spanish ships on a contractual basis. They had some rights and had to give back some of the robbed materials and or transfer to the crown. Then you had in the wagon tracks in the Wild West, they were all based on contracts. Few people know that. They were completely based on contracts. What happened if you want to leave the track, and what's happening?
Sorry, then?
Wagon trails.
The wagon trails. So the settlers who were going west had a bunch of rules that were...
They had that each wagon trail had a contractual system.
What kind of things, though? What were the contracts for what?
For what is your duties and obligations and your rights. For example, you can leave the group under certain circumstances and then get paid some money back, and you have to follow the leader of the trail for certain areas, and this is your property, and there's common property, and in case of attack, you have to behave like this and that.
That's interesting, because it's not a the free private city idea in its modern incarnation is not a result of the times we live in, is it? Contracts have been around for a while, and I suppose you could argue that digitization is certainly streamlining it all. Because an event, in another 50 years, it'll be very streamlined,
Yeah, I think The problem is that we are coming from another world since thousands and thousands of years, that there's a ruler and we have to obey. And the only thing we managed, because it was so powerful and successful over such a long period of time, that we have now just said, hey, let's replace the ruler by an elected ruler, right? This is the only innovation we managed. But the idea that there's not necessarily a ruler at all, but a service provider, this is just, it's too new. It's too far away from our thinking. But interestingly, as you said, the service comes around. That's my car trader example, you say. You go to a car dealer and say, I want to buy a car. And the car dealer says, yes, you can buy a car, but here's the conditions. I choose the model, the color, the motor, the interior, and the price you have to pay. And you said, are you mad? But you would accept, you're not accepting that, right? It's crazy. But you are exactly accepting that in your relationship to the state. When it comes to the services you get from the state and the taxes you have to pay. It's exactly that relationship. They decide everything, including the price you have to pay. And you must buy. And that's why I try to tell people, read my book, look, this is what I'm proposing is a model you already know. You haven't just used it for this market of living together. But we can. And my explanation why this has not been recognized before is because it's just unthinkable, because we are so used to this, there have to be rulers, powerful rulers. Today it's more the wise rulers, but it's the same, right? We cannot decide for ourselves when it comes to living together. And I say, why not?
Yeah, but why now? Like, what is it that has triggered this?
Pain.
Really?
Pain of the current Western democracies becoming more and more authoritarian states.
But, I mean, authoritarians have been around for thousands of years, haven't they?
Yeah, but, I mean, you would not have been cancelled your bank account for just speaking out against the government. That was not the case 20 years ago, right? And things like that. It has become much more strict. Even I know that a lot of people deny that, but I can say that's objectively the case. The corridor of allowed opinion is very narrow. Much narrower than it was 20, 30 years before. I can say out of own experience from a Western country. And in so far, this is now a high time.
It is, and it's high time we went to dinner as well, I believe.
So.
Thank you once again, Titus, for gracing our ears with your words. Another great episode, and I look forward to your speaking in a couple of days, as I should imagine, at the conference. Really looking forward to that one. Last year was great, but I'm really genuinely excited this year, because there are some really, not only are there more projects.
More projects than ever before.
But there are more working examples of things that have actually happened. And that's what I find the most fascinating. That's what I find the most exciting, is piecing together this playbook, basically, because I've been listening to people talk about Free Cities now for almost a year. Is it? Well, it was after the last conference that we started the podcast, and I have to say I was curious when I came, but I thought I didn't understand how important it was, and now I'm fully invested in understanding how important it is to work out how we move forward with governance.
Absolutely.
And I'm surprised at myself, actually, because I didn't think that would happen. And obviously, in some part, that's thanks to you. So thanks for that. But really, yeah, really, I am intrigued now beyond, I'm working for the cause 100%, because I think whatever transpires, is important, and not just the successes, but the failures as well, to know what it is we're supposed to be doing to create these better societies.
Yeah, and this is one of the advantages of our times. We are all connected, right? We can learn quickly from failures and successes. We can bring people together. I'm happy that for the first time, the new Free State Project New Hampshire is also there and presenting. So we can really, I'm sure after the conference, everybody will go home and say, wow, that is exciting and didn't know that before, right? I also, I'm curious about the Lieberstadt project in Norway, which I haven't heard live ever before, right? I knew about them, but very interesting, very interesting.
Great, well, look forward to speaking to you next time, whatever that is. Let's hope when next time we speak, we've got even more projects to talk about.
But yeah, hopefully.
Thanks for talking again. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.